What we're looking at here to get started is one of some people, I tend to be among them, think this is one of the most amazing pictures taken during the 20th century. And this is Earthrise seen from the moon as taken by the astronauts. It just gives us a sense of this so-called little blue bubble in space. So I'm going to go through four slides which give a sense of the sort of modern scientific view of the universe. The second of here is our little blue dot with our own Milky Way galaxy in the background. So we've gone from the view of Earthrise from the moon to a different view with the galaxy in the background, and now we move to what is the Milky Way galaxy, and here we are. So as we move out, we can get a sense of really, in some sense, how infinitesimal we are relative to the size of the universe, but at the same time, how, I don't know if the word special is right or not, but our ability to think about all of this and to learn about it and to understand it and have a clear perception of it is really quite unique. And then finally, this is our Milky Way galaxy in relationship to other galaxies, the billions of galaxies that inhabit our vast universe. And that little blue dot now seems to be so important, and yet at the same time so insignificant in relationship to the entire size of the universe, and that makes it even more special and worth protecting and preserving, because this is our home. For better or worse, this is it. And what happens in the future, of course, is one of the huge speculations about where humanity is ultimately destined, and we're a long ways from what will happen to our own sun, which is basically a nuclear furnace that's kind of burning itself up. But these are issues that Al is actually going to deal with during the fourth week of our presentations. So this gives a just kind of an overview sense of the enormity of the universe, and this is really something that builds on what Walt talked about too, because as he took us through the journey of scientific discovery, it becomes very, very clear that this is the outcome of the modern scientific view of the universe. So basically our book then builds on the two previous books that we've had the privilege to publish, and also that we presented to earlier Kerygma classes. The first one is God is Here to Stay, and the second one is God and Randomness. And in many ways, this current book, which is called Christianity and Evolutionary Pluralism, is the third book in a trilogy of books on faith and science, or science and religion, science and faith. The first book talks about the structure of the universe, which generally tends to reinforce the cosmological argument and the teleological arguments that Walt presented to us earlier in some of the presentations. And in that particular book, we explore the dynamic structure of the universe. And observe how really orderly and structured it is, and what the common elements are, and the standard model, and electromagnetic spectrum, and gravity, and strong and nuclear, weak nuclear forces, and so on. Leads to the conclusion that the world is so highly structured, or designed, if we want to think of it that way, that a very, very strong argument can be made for there being an intelligent creator who brought all of this into existence. But we will explore that a little bit later in our presentations. God and Randomness looks at the random events that occur within that structure. And both of these generally tend to focus on the big picture of God, the universe, God, and Randomness. The third book is called Christianity and Evolutionary Pluralism, and it begins to narrow the focus, that is, the science and faith discussion and science and religion discussion within the context of Christianity, our own faith. And it's called Christianity and Evolutionary Pluralism because the purpose of this next book is to try to develop a new perspective in relationship to four other positions on Christianity and science that have been developed. And Al will talk about that next week, and then begin to talk about which of the various positions represents most accurately how modern scientists go about the business of doing science. But that's for next week. So all we're going to do this week, in many ways, is kind of lay out the foundation. Now, here's the chapter structure. The first chapter here is called The Big Questions, and that's what I'm going to do in my presentation today. The next week, Al is really going to take us to through chapters 2 through 6. He's going to telescope all of that and summarize it in a way that allows us to go through some of the earlier understandings of the universe, the period of transition, the transition being completed, and then Christianity and modern science, especially in relationship to the four Christian positions that exist when we talk about the relationship of science to Christianity. So he'll deal with that. Here are chapters 7 through 12, which are the religious pluralism chapters on monotheism, chapter 8, non-monotheism, and then Christian responses to religious pluralism in chapter 10, and then 11, we return to specifically to the four big questions and tie it to Christianity. And then finally, the last chapter is devoted to trying to lay out some basic principles and ideas of position we're trying to develop. Hopefully, all of this will move seamlessly from chapter to chapter. And our perception, and this is very much a part of the assumptions as well as the conclusions that we make about our perspective, is that the world of religious pluralism, while it seems to be very distinct and different from science, is directly connected to it. And we will show the transitions from one to the other and how they are logically related and connect to each other. But that will take us the next 4 weeks to be able to do that. So let's begin. Al and I, whenever we have had an opportunity to think about maybe writing something, have always been inspired by something, an event that triggers a sort of an inspiration for some writing. Al and I have been writing for about 8 years together. We have a very unique partnership, and that he brings the scientific expertise that I lack, and hopefully I can bring some theological, philosophical, humanities expertise that complements his scientific background. But this, for those of you who have not had this experience, it's really quite remarkable. This is Denali, so-called the High One, which if you've been to Alaska on a clear day, you will recognize it. Now, Al and I have the good fortune of being part of what's called the 25% Club. And this just basically means that only 25% of the people who go and view Denali see it without any cloud cover. Now, there's some clouds here that are obscuring a little bit of the mountain. When we were there a couple years ago, it was absolutely completely clear day. It was a very exhilarating experience, and it's one of those kind of moments where you're glad you're there and they last a lifetime. And if you remember, if you've had the fortune to do some travel, there are so many wonderful memories and experiences that come from travel, and this is one of ours that our two families, Al's family and Sally and I, shared together, and really, really enjoyed that experience. And out of that, there emerged what kind of thinking about this book. So part of the first chapter includes what we're calling the cognitive revolution, which goes back about 30 to 70,000 years. And it's basically the platform out of which our human curiosity emerged. Now, according to physical anthropologists, modern humans, Homo sapiens, emerged on this earth about 200,000 years ago, being preceded by Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal and others that go all the way back to Australopithecus, maybe 2, 3 million years ago. The dating of this gets to be a challenge in and of itself. And there's even debate about whether there's one original ancestor for all of us who call ourselves modern humans. And those of you who follow that know that her name is Lucy. She's the original mother back 2 million, some people even say 3.5 million years ago. But these ancient numbers are highly debated. What is clear is that as humanity began to develop the higher brain capacities, called the cerebral cortex or the cerebellum or whatever, we began to emerge as kind of a unique animal species on our planet. It doesn't mean that other animals don't have the capacity to be conscious of their surroundings and so on, but we are seem to be the unique species that has this kind of basic human curiosity about where we came from, where we're going, wondering about life after death, wondering about the nature of the universe and so on and so forth. And this sort of human curiosity has two sides to it. One is the scientific practical side, and the other is the philosophical theological side. So on the left side, you can begin to see we've just got just a couple of little cartoonish visuals here of the atom and a couple of vials in a scientific lab, and then finally the ascent of man, the various stages through which physical anthropologists indicated that we evolved. And then it's not just scientific, pure scientific knowledge that we're interested in, but ultimately this knowledge gets translated into practical applications. And here is a little symbol of the car. And right now, about 35-40% of American economy is tied into the production of the automobile, in terms of petroleum, in terms of synthetic materials for tires, in terms of upholstery, and so on. And all the digital work that goes into operating these cars now, and now that we have the Tesla, we now have a completely 100% electric car and so on. So all of this is a practical application of the scientific principles that have progressively been discovered down through what, 300-400 years, if you want to go back to when modern science begins, which we'll talk about a little bit later. We actually have identified it as 1543. But on the right side here is a philosophical, theological curiosity that we have. And of course, the well-known Rodin statue of the great thinker. Certainly within our own Western tradition, you have Socrates, whom some people say is the founder of Western philosophy, and then Immanuel Kant, who is generally considered the most significant modern philosopher to have developed in the last 200-300 years. In fact, some people argue that all paths, including not just philosophy but theology as well, go back to Kant. And there's some discussion in the philosophy of science literature about how to connect modern theological perspectives back to the work of Immanuel Kant. But this isn't the place for that, other than to say that this kind of side of our thinking is as much a part of our human curiosity as is the scientific practical side. And we live in both of those worlds simultaneously. And the goal is, how do we connect the one to the other? Now, as a result of our experience here with this big rock called Denali, we ask ourselves four questions, which we call the four big questions. The first one is, where did the material universe come from and how does it operate? And in many ways, this, of course, is the domain of science. The second big question is, and this is part, again, of our human curiosity on the right-hand side here, and that is there a spiritual power of some kind that is greater than the material universe? And we live in, and how are they connected? All right. So number three begins to move in that direction. If there is a higher spiritual power, what is the relationship of this spiritual power to the material universe? How are they connected in some way? And how are we not only to understand that in a broad theological sense, but also in terms of the specific sense of our own faith. And if a higher power, spiritual power of some kind does exist, not only how does it connect to the material universe, but how does it relate to our humanity as well? And then how does all of that get filtered through our biblical tradition? And we take that up as well, which we will share with you later. But in the first chapter, we begin to lay out some of our concepts. And one of our fundamental propositions is that there are two ways of knowing. One is a scientific way of knowing, and one is a religious or faith way of knowing. And science, as a way of understanding nature, is based on data and rationality. Its primary focus is on discovery of our material world. Science follows evidence from observations, experimentation, simulations based on accepted natural laws. And science ultimately is a collection of accepted understandings of how the macro, that is the cosmos level, and the microatomic level works. And I've got two little graphics over there in the lower right-hand corner, which both of which are very familiar to people. The first being, of course, an artist's rendition of the universe from the moment of the Big Bang until now, including the width of the universe and its continuing expansion from the point of the initial inflation, which we know of as the Big Bang. And of course, the right hand is the nucleus, is the atom, which is endlessly broken down into various component parts, as Walt has so articulated them in his prior presentations. We also know that one of the components of science is that it is constantly being updated as new discoveries are being made. And Al is the person who can point to that with skill and the detail that describes how that updating occurs constantly. But just as a couple of reminders, we have included a couple of little tables here. One is a average life expectancy, which is on the left side, and then a share of the world's poverty that is undernourished on the right-hand side. This is called actually an inverse relationship, and that is as the amount of undernutrition decreases, let's say from 1970, where it was 28%, to the year 2010, where it was 11%, you would expect life expectancy to increase. And science tracks this. Population science tracks this, nutrition science tracks this, and this is a constant updating of how science progresses and proceeds as it continues to do further research, experimentation, and then catalogs all that or presents all that in a visual form through these kinds of charts, pie charts, bar charts, graphs of all kinds, which Al is particularly good at preparing. Now, once we leave the field of science, we get into the field of religion, and religion consists of, unlike science, which deals with materiality, religion consists of beliefs in a non-physical or a spiritual power that is different from materiality. And this spiritual power, since we're working in the field of religious pluralism, where I have had the good fortune to spend a great deal of time teaching world religion courses for many, many years, and get a sense of the different ways in which the religions of the world understand this spiritual power. Now, everything that I have listed here is a form of theism. That is a fundamental belief that there is a higher spiritual power of some kind that, in fact, created the universe and relates to it in some particular way, as well as relates to humanity. And of course, you will recognize much of this right from the start. Jews called this Yahweh, as you know. For us, Christianity is a Trinitarian form of monotheism, where God is thought of as of three co-equals, three partners, or whatever the right language is, as Father, Son, some say God, Christ, and Holy Spirit. Some don't feel comfortable with the Father Son language anymore because it sounds a little bit, what, I don't want to say paternalistic or whatever, but nonetheless, that's historically the way it's been described, Father Son, Holy Spirit, or Holy Ghost. Word for God in Islam is Allah. For Zoroastrianism, it's called Ahura Mazda, and Ahura Mazda just means wise Lord of the universe. Now, those religions, the top four religions, are monotheistic religions, and they differ from the next few set of religions, three in particular, which are pantheistic religions, and that's Hinduism, And I'm going to explain the difference between Hinduism, between pantheism and monotheism when we get to that. The monotheistics, that'll be the third week, and then non-monotheistic religions. But the Brahman is the God, is the name of God for Hinduism, and Taoism is just called the Tao or a Qi. And in Sikhism, which builds on both Hinduism and Islam, the name for God is Waheguru. And those three are pantheistic religions, and the last one, Shinto, is an animistic religion. And the name of the many deities or spiritual presences in throughout the universe are called kami. Now, just to get a sense of that little graphic on the right-hand side, you may or may not have a sense of what those symbols refer to. The one in the upper right-hand corner is the yin yang symbol, which is associated with Taoism. The one immediately below that, going in a clockwise direction, is a Hindu word for mantra for Om. And then, of course, you'll recognize Christianity. And then that wheel is Buddhism. And the next to that, which is less well known, is really Sikhism. And then, of course, there's Judaism, which is the six-pointed star. And then finally, Islam. And all of those points of view, with the maybe the possible exception of certainly the early form of Buddhism, later forms of Buddhism pick up the idea more of a deity, but all of them have embedded within them some form of belief in a higher spiritual power that transcends materiality, as well as different ways of viewing how it's related to not only the material universe, but to humanity as well. Now, when it comes to the question of religiosity, in many ways, despite the extraordinary pluralism, the large number of religions in the world, which measure into the thousands, really, it may be a little bit pretentious to say, but there are really only four ideas that religions of the world, however they're defined and whatever their traditions are, there are only basically four concepts internally that they work with. And what separates them from each other is the way in which they arrange or think about or relate these four concepts to each other. The first one is materiality, and that's the physical universe experienced through the five senses, and the part of the universe that is subject to scientific analysis. Now, I've included the image of the hand here because it's obviously physical. If somebody says to you, and I do this with my students all the time as a way of introducing the world religions, do you have a hand? And of course, they look at me like I'm a little foolish, maybe even crazy, and say, sure. And they all, I say, let's see it, and they all hold it up. And then I say, do you believe in God? Do you believe you have a soul? And I see many heads will nod, yes, I do. Do you believe in an afterlife? Yes. Do you believe in angels? Yes. And many of them believe they have a guardian angel who protects and provides for them. And then I ask them the question, can you show me the God inside of you, or the soul inside of you, or the afterlife that you believe in? And of course, the answer is no, they can't. They believe in it, but they can't show it in an empirical sense in the same way that they can show me their hand exists. And once we establish this distinction between materiality and spirituality, then it opens up discussions that can go in all different kinds of directions. What do we mean by materiality? How do we know it? How does science discover it? What's its relationship to a higher power of some kind, whether we call it God or Waheguru or Allah or whatever the name is? And then the other two concepts are transcendence, which is to go beyond, that God is a spiritual power that transcends materiality. And the other is immanence, which is God is a spiritual power that is hidden within materiality. Now, here are a couple of examples. When we apply the four concepts to religion, the relationship of materiality and spirituality can be seen in a combination in three different ways, basically. The first one is that God is transcendent only. Now, the classic image that's used here is God, the watchmaker. And I know that Walt referred to this in one of his earlier discussions. God is a watchmaker who winds up the universe and then lets it run on the basis of its own natural laws, but does not intervene. In some sense, that's kind of the Einsteinian position too. Einstein believed that, where there were laws, there was a lawgiver, even though he didn't believe that God was personal. He believed that God created the universe and that the universe ran on its own momentum according to natural law. That's a transcendent view. Aristotle called it the unmoved mover or the uncaused cause. That is, God is the, and this is a cosmological argument, that you can take cause and effect relationships and regress them back to the beginning. This is all done hypothetically. You can't prove it, but nonetheless, this was Aristotle's idea, is that there had to be a first cause somewhere. So where did that first cause come from? Well, it came from an uncaused cause or an unmoved mover who started the process of cause and effect relationships moving in the universe. And modern scientific or the modern theo one of the modern theological interpretations of that model is deism, which was very popular during the time of the founding of our nation. Some people say Thomas Jefferson was a deist, and maybe Washington was, but there's some discussion over whether or not they really were, or whether or not there were different kinds of Christians within the Enlightenment tradition, and that, of course, is another discussion too. Now, immanent only means this is like Native American religions, the Great Spirit. Or Shinto animism, the hidden spirits are called kami. Now, it's really important here to make a distinction because there's a lot of modern sort of New Age religion that sees the physical universe as God. That is not the perspective of immanent only. The idea of immanent only is that there is a material universe, but that the God who created that universe is embedded within that universe. Now, here's another example that can, I think, can serve to make a distinction between a transcendent only. I'm assuming that if you're like me, you have your computer sitting on a desk or a table or some kind of a hard surface. Let's assume it's a desk. And if somebody asks you, is God inside your desk? And for somebody who comes out of a Western religious tradition, the answer is, holy cow, no, not at all. God is not in the desk. God is not in any sort of material part of the universe. God is not in the rocks or the trees. God transcends them. God created the universe. But to think of God as somehow immanently embedded within a rock or a cloud or a table or whatever is a non-Western conception. If I were talking to a Hindu and I were to ask, is God embedded in this table? The chances are very high that the Hindu would say yes, because the Hindu conception of Brahman is that Brahman is not only the creator, which I'll get to, in fact, is not only the creator, and here you get down to C, which is God is both transcendent and immanent, and that is the Hindu pantheistic view. God created a material universe and is immanent within it. That is, it's God is hidden within the material universe. So if somebody were to say, is God within us? A Hindu would say, of course, God is within us. A person who comes out of a monotheistic tradition might say, no, God is not within us, but there is a soul that God implants within us that is different in substance from what God is, whereas a Hindu would think that the soul is of the same substance. And we'll talk a little bit about some of that later, and that's all really critical in terms of the way in which Christians will relate to the world of religious pluralism, which is spreading around the world as a result of the expanding global village, which we'll talk about later as well. So those are three concepts: transcendent only, immanent only, both transcendent and immanent, and there are all kinds of examples that can serve to exemplify those three positions. Now, we also begin in our first chapter to talk about how science and religion or faith are different. Now, although not all scientists agree, there is only one really main view that of the universe that exists among most modern scientists. And as Walt has laid it out for us, so here are some of the parameters of our physical universe. We are starting with the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, or with this 80 billion light years wide and expanding. The process starts with the initial inflation, continues through expansion and evolution, which Al will talk about next week. Our solar system is 4.5 billion years old. Life on Earth, 3.85 billion years old. And of course, humans are 200,000 years old. This is generally widely accepted, although not all Christians agree with this. And it's important, especially, I want to put in a plug next week to be sure to hear what Al has to say, because he's going to lay out what are essentially the four main positions on how Christianity is related to modern science and the different points of view that different Christian scientists and others in the Christian tradition have of how science relates to religion. Very different from the field of religion, even though only one main view of the universe exists within the science space. Within the religion space, there are many religious views. And except for Baha'i, which began in the mid-19th century, the major religions of the world began in pre-modern times under conditions of geographical and cultural isolation, relative cultural isolation, which means as they began to think about the relationship of a higher spiritual power to the material universe, they began to define them in very, very different terms. Now, does there exist a methodology that can bring a similar religious perspective to the diversity of world religions in the same way that science has been able to evolve in the direction of one view of how the universe started and evolved? We're going to deal with that question, but right up front, the answer is no, and for good reason. Now, the reason is why science and religion differ. Science and religion are really two distinct ways of knowing, or as we sometimes say, different kinds of experiences. And the methods that are used in the one area do not apply to the other. Scientists use methods to discover the laws of nature by which the material universe operates, and the methods used by religious scholars combine materiality and spirituality. Religions differ over the nature of the spiritual power and how it relates to the universe and to humanity, and as we said, either in terms of transcendence only, immanence only, or both. Now, what are the strengths and the limitations of science? And then we'll talk about the strengths and the limitations of religion or faith. The strengths of science, and this is where Al will draw upon his experience as a scientist, especially through the National Academy of Sciences criteria and so on next week, to talk about what are the methods that modern scientists use and the consensus that is built up around those methods that have led to a consensus of outcomes. And as we said, many scientists, most scientists actually, whether they go from anthropology to zoology, accept a single modern scientific view of the universe. And this is covered in chapters 2 through 6. The limitations of science are is that when an assumption is made about the existence of a spiritual power, or a conclusion is drawn about the existence of the potential existence of a spiritual power out of examination of scientific activity, or a level of reality that is greater than materiality, science cannot prove or disprove this assumption. Now, the issue of proof and disproof is debated as to what these words mean. There are some who say that science doesn't prove anything. It just describes the facts about the nature of the universe, and that is constantly changing. So what does the question of proof refer to, or disproof, or non-proof? In the field of mathematics, the concept of proof is used all the time. 2 + 2 = 4. Now, when we talk about the law of gravity, that can be translated into mathematical terms. This has been pointed out many, many times already. Does this 32 feet per second squared, which is the universal law of gravitation, mathematical formula, does that prove that there is a universal law of gravitation? Well, I don't know. It depends on how one wants to interpret it. Also, there's a debate between science as fact versus truth. and that science deals with facts and philosophy or other disciplines deal with truth, but to the extent that science tries to describe reality with as much accuracy as possible in terms of science, does this mean that science is describing something that is truthful about the nature of the universe, even though that truth isn't truth in full, but only in part? So are we talking about semantics here or what? But clearly what science can't do is prove or disprove some theological assumptions. Now, this belongs to the world of theology. Let me give just a couple examples. Perhaps the core Christian faith principle is that Christ died for the sins of the world. Now, there's just no way that using the methods of modern science can this be proven. When Hindus say that Brahman permeates the physical universe as a spiritual power, science cannot prove this. When Muslims say that the Quran is the earthly, manifestation of the perfect word of Allah that exists in paradise, there is no way to prove or disprove those assumptions. They belong to the arena of theology and philosophy. So the question we ask is, how do we use science to get to theology and philosophy? What are the implications of science for theology and philosophy in terms of positive contributions that science can make to our understanding of the universe as a highly structured environment? But how far can we then not go into maybe taking the next theological step to make some kind of an assumption then beyond that reasonable conclusion that there is a spiritual power of some kind that is greater than the material universe or created it? And even though that the best scientific information tells us the universe began 13.8 billion years ago with this initial Big Bang, there's no way to get beyond that physical, physical explosion or reality to assume that there was some kind of a power behind it that brought it into existence. That has to be ultimately some sort of spiritual assumption. And that's one of the limitations of science, but it's not a negative of science against science because that's not what science deals with. It's the philosophy and the theology spheres that deal with those kinds of questions about how a spiritual power greater than the material universe is in fact related to it as science has described it for us and continues to probe it at greater depths of understanding. Now, here are the strengths and limitations of religion or faith. What faith brings us is a sense of meaning and purpose in life. It brings us comfort in times of trial and times of need. It definitely provides us with moral guidance in terms of the ethical concepts and the prescripts and the prescriptions and the postscriptions that are a part of the moral guidance that all the religions provide. And certainly it gives one a sense of direction in life. I've heard it said so many times, I was born to do this, or God has called me to do this, or my purpose in life, according to I understand why I am here, according to my faith, is such and so. And that is very, very, very normal within the domain of religion, that's what religion will provide or faith brings to the human experience. It's a different level or kind of experience or different way of knowing than what we know about the physical universe according to the methods and discoveries of science. Now, however, there are also limitations to this, and that unlike modern science, this has led to a shared scientific view of the universe. For religion, it just really is not possible to arrive at a shared view of a spiritual power that is greater than the material universe. It's just that we can't get to that level in the way that science can get to the level of uncovering many of the laws of nature. The religions that make different assumptions about the existence of a spiritual power is a matter of faith. And so I think what we try to start with is to conclude that for all intents and purposes, modern science has given us an overarching single view of our material universe. And in religion, many different views of the spiritual power that is greater than materiality exist. And the question is how to understand those that assumption about a greater spiritual power to materiality and to humanity is one of the major challenges. And sitting in the middle of that, of course, is our faith of Christianity. So not only are we called upon to understand our physical universe in the sense of sciences revealing it to us, but also how Christianity increasingly, and historically as well, but increasingly relates to a world of shared and very distinct and different religious visions about the nature of the spiritual power that brought this universe into existence and is connected to humanity in some way. And as our world becomes more increasingly pluralistic as a result of electronic technologies like the computer and mass communication as well as mass transportation, we become increasingly more aware of our differences. And one of the issues that we take up later in this book is how should Christians who become increasingly aware of the religious diversity of the world relate to people with different religious views. And that becomes part of the agenda of this book. But in this first chapter, we just raise these questions and issues, which we are going to explore later. Now, here basically what we have is an overview of the book. And Al's very, I give him credit, he can do things with a computer that I cannot do. And I just so much appreciate him for this. But this is a 2x2 table. And on the left-hand side, there's a pre-modern, which we identify before 1543, which is a date which he will talk about next week in terms of Copernicus, and modern science, which is after 1543. So there is in cell one here a pre-modern scientific understanding of the universe. And we have developed an enormous appreciation for the discoveries of pre-modern scientists based upon the limitations of the technology and tools that they had. That's really quite remarkable discussion. But a lot has changed as a result of the emergence of modern science. And our understanding of the universe now is very, very different, starting with our own sun-centered view of our own solar system versus an Earth-centered. But it took a while to get there, because for centuries and centuries, it was strongly believed that we were an Earth-centered universe, not just solar system, but entire universe. And now, of course, our views of that have changed quite dramatically as a result of this critical date of 1543, which does begin to cause a shift between pre-modern and modern scientific views. Table 2 and 4 deal with the spiritual level. So we have a kind of a pre-modern and a modern spirituality as well. Cell 2 refers to multiple religions that emerge in cultural isolation. And cell 4 deals with multiple religions that continue to exist, but continue to interact with greater frequency within an emerging global village. And the challenge of Christianity is to deal with both cells, cell 3, which is modern science, and cell 4, which is pluralism, and to try to connect the two. And that, in fact, is what we will do, and hopefully we will do it in the next four sessions that we spend with you, so that the next presentation is scheduled for a week from tonight, November 8th, and that will be Al's opportunity to introduce us into much of what occurs in cells 1 and 3.